Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Daniel Paris, host of New Books in Finance, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm delighted to have as my guest today Robert Polin. He is the co-author, along with Noam Chomsky, of the just published Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, The Political Economy of Saving the Planet, just out from Verso Press. Robert, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks very much for having me on.
So this is a very timely issue, probably the single greatest public policy issue facing the planet is global warming and the discussions around it. And you have a kind of a seat at the table with your view on it. It's a really tricky issue. People are extremely divided about it. Lots of different approaches to climate change and the economics of climate change. And as we'll get into, some really tricky kind of economic questions that a professional economist such as yourself takes up, discount rates and GDP costs and so forth. Give us your perspective, an overview of your perspective, why you and your co-author have chosen to write this now, and what territory you want to kind of stake out for our listeners.
I've been working on the topic for about 13 years now. Really, my background is a macroeconomist, and macroeconomists study economic growth, job creation, recessions, financial markets, and that's what I did and continue to do. But so I would say 13 or 14, it wasn't like I didn't know about climate change and wasn't concerned. But about 13 years ago, it occurred to me I can't keep doing work on macroeconomics without thinking about how the climate crisis plays into everything we do in macro. So, you know, if we're talking about the economy growing, what is the impact of economic growth on emissions, carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions? And then there was the thing that really focused my attention, because it was close to other things that I had worked on, was the argument that was pervasive, and I would say probably is still dominant, which is that, okay, if we want to do something about climate, we can. There are policy tools that we can pursue. They can be effective. But if we do those, we're sacrificing well-being, standard measured well-being, like people having jobs. And so it became crystallized as jobs versus the environment. And there were, you know, there was polls taken, including in highly respectable places like the New York Times, which is more important to you, jobs or the environment? And it seemed to me that this was posing the very question wrong. Not that I needed to get the right answer, but the question itself was wrong. The premise that in order to protect the environment, in order to pursue a viable climate stabilization path, we have to sacrifice material well-being. And so really that was the starting point for my research, and I've been on it in various ways ever since. So this specific project with Professor Chomsky emerged out of just discussions. Well, we had done some joint short interviews, and it was really just kind of the imperative of how can we get this message out that we only have a limited amount of time to pursue a serious climate stabilization path that really, you know, literally the future of life on Earth as we know it is at stake. I'm not saying everyone's going to be dying in the next 30 years, but we are on an extremely perilous path. We're playing Russian roulette with the environment. And how do we help push the story out such that we have a solution, we have a way through which we can achieve a viable climate stabilization path, and do so in a way that does not sacrifice material well-being for the overwhelming majority of the people.
Let me just stop you there, just so for provide some context for the listeners. The book, by the way, is in the form of an interview with a third party, one of your associates interviewing you and Professor Noam Chomsky. So it's very conversational. It's not, you know, academic journal account of carbon gas levels and so forth, and all of the details. It is a very readable account of these issues from an economic perspective, granted, but takes on these issues at a fairly high level that I think most people like you, professionals who are going about their business, but also realizing, climate change has a big impact on whatever your business is, frankly. I think all of us can agree that almost whatever we do, we can sense the impact of climate change on it. So it's at that level where it's not a super technical text. So I just wanted to make that clear to readers.
Thank you. The aim in writing the book was so that seriously, an intelligent high school student can not just get through it, but can appreciate it, can absorb the points, can, you know, learn from it, can critique it. That's really the audience that we aim for, and anybody more sophisticated. But I seriously think that a high school student who has to be interested in the subject, of course, would not find any barriers, certainly not any technical kind of barriers to.
Yeah, your co-author sometimes goes off script, but that's already kind of a given. I should mention again, your background as an economist, you are a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and co-director of political economy research institute at UMass. So you have this background. Bringing the economics into it, and I work in finance by day and have done a lot of interviews with economists over the years for this podcast. We end up talking about discount rates and GDP more often than we should. They're really, really, really flawed. But I think one of the things that's challenging, and as I've reviewed several books on this, and I hope you can try to address it from the inside, is that for whatever reason, it's not a problem, but for whatever reason, the leading figures of discussing climate change have settled on where are we going to be at the end of the next century, of this century, excuse me, 2100, 80 years from now, with some waypoints 2030, 2040, 2050, but really an 80-year exercise. Reasonably so, because climate change has occurred over a couple centuries, the causes, and it can't be changed overnight. But when you start talking about solutions, global public policy that's going to have an impact over 80 years, it can get very wonky very quickly, regardless of which side that you're on. And I wonder if as you say, for the high schooler or the reasonably perceptive, just professional reading this, do these people, regardless of which side, and there are multiple sides on the economic policy perspective, what kind of meaning does this have when you change a discount rate by 25 basis points and 80 years later you have a dramatic change in whatever the outcome is, or the growth rates, or the forecasts and so forth? Just as an economist dealing with long tails, forecasting is hard. Mm-hmm. How did you do that as you were working through this?
Well, I didn't model it in the way that, for example, William Nordhaus, who won the Nobel Prize 2 years ago for his work on climate economics. I didn't focus on the issue of the relative sacrifices that we have to make in order to achieve, 1.5 degree stabilization, 1.5 degree centigrade increase in the average temperature relative to the pre-industrial level, or 2 degrees or 3 degrees. I took a different tack, which is to say, okay, we know what the climate scientists tell us where we have to be. And I take as a kind of totally mainstream approach the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and their 2018 report said we have to get emissions down by 45% in 10 years and 100% net zero by 2030. So then I look at the various economic models that estimate how much it would cost in terms of investment to basically ramp up clean, renewable energy and invest in energy efficiency such that we can hit that target. And then I look at the impact of those investments on an economy that is moving forward. And what my basic finding is that, look, this is good for overall economy, as long as we manage it reasonably intelligently. It's going to create jobs. It's going to create a lot more jobs than maintaining our existing fossil fuel dominant infrastructure. That's true in the United States. That's true in Western Europe. That's true in Africa. That's true in India. That's true in China. Solar, wind power, geothermal power, small scale hydro are already on average at cost parity with fossil fuel-based energy. That is a fact that you can get by looking at documents from the Donald Trump Department of Energy, believe it or not. So the real question for me, the most interesting, important, challenging question is how do we mount this investment project? Because that's what you're saying you talk about with your clients in the business world. It's an investment model. And investments, a lot of people think of investments as good, as positive, forward thinking, building new things, creating new opportunities. So that's really the way I think about it. How do we do this investment project that will enable us to get to a net zero emissions economy, a clean energy economy? And what will be the impact on opportunities for people in terms of standard things, incomes, wages, business opportunities? There will be a lot of new business opportunities, especially way more for small-scale businesses and non-traditional businesses like co-ops. There's already energy co-ops in the Midwest in the United States. So that was really the way that I thought about the economic challenge.
Fair enough. And again, it's probably better. I did tangle with discount rates and GDP figures, because GDP is such a flawed measure of success in this world, but it's the only one we're going. So in some ways, it's easier just to think of, you know, what are the practical policy implications near term. One of the things that I have found, and I was hoping you would address, because I think it will jump out at readers, is that it does appear to be the case that as someone comments on climate policy as a global policy initiative, the background politics really do come into play. Heretofore in this interview, we're 13 minutes in, I could be talking with any climate person, but you're not any climate person. You really have very strong views about the economics of how societies are organized and how using a climate policy initiative could also address what are very important to you, social issues of inequality and so forth. So there's a great deal on the politics. I think that has to be understood because, for instance, I mentioned to you in our green room, recently interviewed another author whose politics are completely the opposite of yours. And they're also trying to come up, but they come up with a solution which doesn't involve all of the investments that you're recommending. So it the politics does really play a role. How do you, as you try to, I think you write somewhere in the book, I'm trying to look over my notes the exact place, but somewhere where it is politically feasible, economically sustainable, but politically feasible somewhere in there. And I'm, you know, the politics of this account with Noam Chomsky are not right down the middle. How do you try to present that so that it is feasible and you get the support of the broad middle. And basically, there's not much of a broad middle left in this country at this point, unfortunately, as we've all observed. But if there were the broad middle, how do you appeal to the broad middle at this point?
Well, I can tell you on the ground, at this very moment, I'm writing these clean energy projects for 9 different U.S. states. I've already done 3 other states. Now, true, the people that commissioned me to write these studies are mainly left of center environmental groups and labor groups. But we know that, you know, a lot of the labor movement has been quite hostile around climate issues. So, for example, a study that I published a year ago for the state of Colorado that was commissioned by the state-level AFL-CIO, totally mainstream labor movement, the labor movement commissioned it, paid for it, supported it, and not only the top administrators and so forth, but the building trades, who have been generally quite hostile to anything to do with climate politics, advancing the Green New Deal. They put their names on it. They endorsed it. So I think in that sense, I've succeeded in capturing the broad middle. And the reason is not because of anything special that I myself wrote, but that if you just think about it really carefully, it's a positive agenda for advancing job opportunities and general well-being. Now, it doesn't guarantee any of those things, but in terms of, you say, GDP, I totally agree that GDP has all kinds of things wrong with it. But the way that I've framed the climate stabilization path, the investment project, there is no reason to think that GDP has to go down at all. Some things are going to grow a lot. That makes GDP grow, meaning investments in the clean energy are going to grow a lot. Correspondingly, of course, the fossil fuel economy is going to contract. But the growth of the clean energy economy is going to create a lot more jobs and a lot more opportunity than the contraction of the fossil fuel economy. So the broad, now, of course, the fossil fuel companies aren't going to like that. But if we create transition policies, fair, just transition policies, even for workers and communities in the affected fossil fuel dependent areas, that should enable them to come around and see, look, this is something we have to do for environmental reasons, but we should also think of it as an opportunity to really do some innovative things.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So fair enough. And again, even I think everyone agrees that investment in green energy is a very good idea. There seems to be agreement on a carbon tax as well. Curiously, far left and far right seem to realize that a globally enforced carbon tax, because otherwise with leakage, it just won't work. But a globally enforced carbon tax makes sense. Investment makes a lot of sense. But you're also talking, and maybe more your co-author, but you know, reorganization of social and economic relationships in society, not just fixing, fixing a technology climate problem, but using a climate problem to reorder society. That's going to get the attention of some people and the opposition of others.
Well, let's just say that if I were to say, look, the only thing I want to do is get to zero emissions, and everything else about U.S. capitalism or any other society, we're going to put that aside for the moment. If we were just to say we have that one narrow focus, that still means we're effectively shutting down one of the biggest global industries in the world over the next 30 years. That is pretty much unprecedented. It will entail massive political mobilization. Now, of course, that massive political mobilization is not going to just be people that are isolated and say, we think everything else about society is fine. We just want to shut down the fossil fuel companies. That's not the way it's going to work. That's not how it does work. So that what is going to be, of course, is going to be a coalition of different forces. And so, for example, around this idea of a Green New Deal, there are groups within that coalition that think, okay, the climate issue we care about, but we really care more about racism. We care about inequality in the cities. We care about, yes, transportation. We care about housing costs. So all of those things are going to be interconnected. And yes, people will have different points of emphasis and things that they think are important. I think we can take this opportunity to build a green economy as also an opportunity to advance equality. We have experienced in the last, since roughly 1980, massive increases in inequality. And we're seeing the results of that now. We're seeing the results of tremendous extent of resentment by huge proportions of the population over their sense that they've been left behind. And they're right. And so this can be that by creating job opportunities and new investment opportunities and new communities, this is also a way through which we can transform society to make it more equal and just.
So you do, it just for the reader, do argue pretty strongly that you mentioned cooperatives as a private business enterprise are okay, as it were. But in the path in the Green New Deal, you don't see much room for larger scale private enterprise as receiving the largesse of this investment. That, you know, I think there's a 50% private, 50% public investments, but a big role for the government as opposed to what you refer to as neoliberal capitalists or neoliberal economists who are arguing in favor of the private sector seeing a profit motive in green energy and acting on it. You just don't buy that.
No, I do buy it. In fact, I myself am a green capitalist. I have a small business that we do investments and we finance things. So I'm definitely not against it, or I'd be a total hypocrite. It's a question of proportions, and it's a question of, you know, to what extent. And it's a question of what does it really take to move the agenda forward. If we are going to wait for big, giant corporations that are expecting 15% rates of return before they're going to make one move to, let's say, start installing solar panels on the roofs of office buildings, we're never going to get to a climate path. What we really need, therefore, we need massive subsidies for investments. We need public investments and subsidies for private investments. But if there's going to be subsidies for private investments, then the deal is that the private companies have to accept lower rates of return. That always has to be. If the state is reducing your risk, the state is giving you a benefit, then in exchange, you have to accept a lower rate of return. That's the principle. I know that's not how we operate now. Now we operate on the principle of basically corporate socialism, wherein the government absorbs risk, reduces risk for private companies, and then the companies take all the benefit. That's not really a socially ethical way to organize an economy.
So if we are going to use, you know, a larger role for the government in mitigating risk and therefore justifying lower returns, you're still faced with the position that we have an 80-year policy outlook and policy measurement period, which is hard under any circumstance for any project, and determining who, you know, what the right policy metrics are. In some of the other literature that I've read, the math that you're looking at about what percentage of the investment in the GDP would be necessary to achieve some of the Paris goals, is it 2.5% of GDP per year? Is it more? That, I suspect, is highly debatable and will change. You know, could be 5 times as much, could be 10 times as much. It could be perhaps less if someone comes up with a really, hydrogen power really quickly. Your co-author, I think, and you also referenced that the amount of GDP that was spent on World War II as a percentage of the U.S. economic activity was something on the order of 90%, and that kind of worked out in a sense that this is not that big of an ask for a nationwide effort. It would have to be global effort, but in terms of U.S. GDP, a nationwide effort. Is that a fair summary?
Well, here's how I did, the 2.5% of GDP, I didn't pull it out of the sky. What I did was look at the figures actually from the U.S. Energy Department as to their estimate of how much it costs to build capacity for, say, solar power, wind power, and how much it costs to raise the efficiency of automobiles or buildings or industrial equipment. So I took those numbers and then I inflated them just to make sure I wasn't undercounting anything. I could be off, but that's really the numbers that was the basic methodology I used. And it's also the case that, so I use my own methodology. If I look at other models, I've been looking at other models just today and the last few days by very credible people. They're in the same range.
I think Nordhaus is in the 4% range, something like that. I could be wrong, but they're, as you say, they're in the same range.
Yeah. So, I think it's reasonable if it's 3% of GDP, that still means that 97% of GDP is being used on other things. And that's in the context of a growing economy. So, there are more things getting done and we are channeling 3%. We can't think that 3% is just getting tossed away. That 3% is generating jobs. It is delivering energy at a lower price on average than the existing energy system. It is creating job opportunities. And for the average consumer, it's going to mean lower energy costs, not higher. And the reason it's lower, if we allow that on average, that renewable energy is on average at rough parity with fossil fuel energy, and that we are investing heavily in raising energy efficiency standards, that means it's going to cost less to get, the energy services you need. It's going to cost less to drive 1,000 miles. It's going to cost less to air condition your house over the summer. So, yeah.
I mean, there is agreement, again, as I said, devil's in the detail as to the costs and the benefits, but I think there is broad agreement that yes, innovation and investment in green energy is a good thing. No one's disagreeing with that. It's just the costs, the returns, the time frame, and the benefit are all subject to a tremendous amount of uncertainty, in particular given the long cycle nature of this. And that's part of the problem that I think. You mentioned, people who for whom you're working now have drawn up programs that, many segments of society just don't know how to figure out or think about we need to do something that's good in 80 years, but it's going to cost us now. That's a hard sell. Particularly, I have to say, when we're heading in a period in society right now, not just this society but globally, where cooperative ventures are struggling. And ethno or national or state-based initiatives and ethno-nationalism are on ascendant. And, there are a lot of challenges to the Paris Accord, and it doesn't have to do just with, single country in India, China, emerging markets, Russia, Brazil, the United States. There's just a lot of challenges to this right now. There's agreement on the problem. There's an agreement that investment is a part of the solution. After that, the knives come out. And I just, I'm saddened by that because it's hard for me to see how we get any type of global policy going forward at this point in time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's fair to say that, at least as I'm presenting it, we don't exactly what I'm saying. In my perspective, it's not like we get a payoff in 80 years and we sacrifice for the next 79 years in order to get the payoff in year 80. In fact, I'm saying we're going to see benefits now. These studies that I referred to at different state levels, they are programs to move the economy now through not just clean energy, but the focus is clean energy investments to get out of the recession, to generate jobs, and to move on to a long-term sustainable path. So I see the benefits now. The big, big hurdle is to understand how you can inject the financing in order to get these immediate investment benefits, these immediate job benefits. And of course, yes, there's no question that the fossil fuel economy is going to have to experience demise. That's just the way it is. As it happens, the U.S. oil companies are down. You know, they were down by 50% in terms of their market valuation. The U.S. government could have bought the entire U.S. private fossil fuel sector for $350 billion a couple of months ago, and that would have been the end of it. They could have bought 51% for $351 billion, and then they could have managed a quite stable, steady decline of the industry and the transition to clean energy. So they're going to face termination, but the rest of the economy is going to see economic benefits as measured in a standard way, not in 80 years, next year.
Okay, to be determined. Let's go over again, other than investment, part of the work is the specific policy of the Green New Deal. We've provided an overview here, obviously in investment, but some handcuffs on the private industry in regard to energy right now. But go over how, if you were in a position to just implement tomorrow, the key points for the Green New Deal, they would be exactly what?
Okay. So I just put out something for the state of Maine a week ago. So I have a very precise proposal. I did one for California about a month ago. We just start investing right now in energy efficiency and clean renewable energy. And I also trace through some of the things that really you start to see benefits like next week. We can start retrofitting buildings. We can retrofit public buildings, save taxpayers money. You have to do the.
And the capital for this comes from where?
Yeah. So that's what I was just going to say. So, I mean, the simplest way to think about that is if we think about public buildings, that the public sector floats bonds, the state floats bonds. As you probably know, the Federal Reserve just opened a new facility for the purchase of state and local government bonds to help stimulate out of the recession. The Federal Reserve is pumping something like $4 to $5 trillion into purchasing bonds and other forms of loans to Wall Street, the private market. So they could easily finance this, focused on things at first and initially on things that would create jobs like right away. Like, let's retrofit all the public buildings in the state of Ohio starting next week. We can do that. It's not a high-tech operation. It creates jobs for people at all levels of credentials and backgrounds. And then from there, yes, move on. From there, we start thinking about installing solar panels on every roof. We start thinking about putting wind turbines on farmlands where farmers like it. It creates a second source of income. You can space them. You only need about 5 to 10% of the land area, and you can still grow crops. You can still have animals grazed.
This is, by the way, for readers, I think this is worth a little detour. It's actually one of the really interesting parts of the disagreement over this is the amount of land that would be taken up for some of the green energy proposals. And there are disagreements as to whether it's a lot of land or a little land, but it's actually quite fascinating and mm-hmm. worth the read, not just in your book, but also others, something that you might not have expected, but as a reader, that the land usage turns out to be a critical point for everyone in discussing climate yeah. policy.
Yeah. So in our book, what I basically work from the calculations of Mara Prentice, who's a physicist at Harvard, who has an outstanding book called Energy Revolution. And she goes through, to the point of understanding how much energy is coming off the sun and is going to hit a solar panel, and how much is going to therefore be absorbed and then gets translated into electricity. So I worked with Prentice and we did calculations. And basically, if we think about putting solar panels on roofs, putting wind turbines in agricultural land, we're really thinking about maybe a half of 1% of the U.S. land area required to get us to a 100% renewable energy economy, which is, of course, a high efficiency renewable energy economy. Now, yes, other people have made different points. I think Professor Prentice successfully demonstrates how much we need. And her research has also been corroborated recently by other authors who focus on this issue. So I think it's a pretty good story. So we're looking at, one half of 1% of land area, which means if we think about rooftops, if we think about parking lots with putting solar panels in parking lots, and if we think about using farmland, share of the farmland for dual use purpose, including the turbines, it's really not a serious constraint.
It is not. And I guess I probably come out on your side with that. Recently drove through the West, and I think the land is not an issue. But the returns on investment and the amount of capital needed for this, and the amount of carbon diminution that would result from this. There's no doubt that if you put up all of these wind farms and solar panels, it employs people, they're reasonably good jobs and so forth. But it the carbon intensity of the periodicity of that type of energy as opposed to carbon-based energy, given the size and scope of our economy, as well as the size and scope of the Chinese and Indian economies, it can't even compare. And so that's the shortcoming that a wind farm and solar panel feels great, but it just doesn't move the needle enough to meet demand, not so much from this country where the demand is not growing as much, but it's very large, but the growing demand for services that require energy in emerging markets, specifically China and mm-hmm. in India, and getting them on board. They're building a lot of, even Japan's building a lot of coal-fired plants, but the Chinese and the Indians have their reasons for going forward with their program because of the basic, energy intensity of fossil fuels. It's going to be a very hard counter argument to make with them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been engaged with people in India. I wrote a paper with an Indian co-author. The paper actually got a lot of attention in India, including in the top mainstream press. And my co-author, the Indian, was meeting with the current government, which you think would be hostile around these issues. I think, it's similar to the United States. There's no reason to think that we can't develop a 100% clean energy economy in India. And there's some very prominent energy engineers in India that have made this point from an engineering standpoint. We've tried to do it from an economic standpoint. Now, it's the same issue. You do have to get over the hump. You have to be able to really move the financing. The technologies are fine. They can improve. But we're at an adequate level of technology now because of solar costs having come down so dramatically in the last decade.
Indeed.
So how do we actually deliver that financing? That is the massive question. And of course, in addition to that is the political question. But there's no reason, I don't think, and I'm not the only one, there's no reason to think that India can't do quite well as a clean energy economy. As it is, half of the people that live in rural India have no access to electricity. never have, despite promises by every single politician that ever addressed the issue. So by creating the opportunity for microgrids, for small-scale solar wind combination, and you do need to address the storage issue, which you referred to. It's true. Obviously, the sun doesn't shine all day. Wind doesn't blow all the time. So you need to have backups. But keep in mind that this question of storage, which is extremely important, we don't have to answer that one right now. Because even if we say we are going to be 100% clean energy in 30 years, that is 30 years from now. And in the meantime, we still will be relying to some significant extent on fossil fuel energy. So that can provide the underlying baseload while we expand the clean energy economy.
Okay, I think we've made that point. Investment, investment, and investment. I do want to make the point that you, and maybe it's more your co-author, but it is also you, do come out a little bit more aggressively on neoliberal economics and market-based systems than maybe you're presenting it here. So, you know, the readers will want to, I think, know that and understand that there's some sharp elbows on the political side in this book. One would expect nothing less from Noam Chomsky. And that, you know, that's part of the equation. This is an opportunity not only to fix a global problem about energy and climate, but also you're taking it as an opportunity to address other issues that you and your co-author feel very strongly about. I have to say that.
No, I don't hide from that at all. If I were afraid of presenting that, I certainly wouldn't be writing a book with Professor Noam Chomsky. I mean, it's a great honor. That's how I feel. It was a great honor that Noam was interested in doing this project with me. So, I'm not the least bit shy about it. But, you know, if you really look at what Noam says and you look at what we're talking about, it's really quite kind of, we would say it's quite moderate social democracy. I mean, the idea of moderate social democracy, or what, you know, the term one of my professors used to have way back was a slightly imaginary Sweden, a version of Sweden that is, you know, a little more idealistic than the current real life Sweden. That does not seem like such a big stretch. And, you know, you can read people like in the Financial Times, Martin Wolf, probably the leading financial journalist in the world, who would tell you, oh, yes, Swedish social democracy, that's one of the best systems ever devised. Now, obviously, we don't just copy Sweden and the blueprint, but the idea of a mixed economy with an underlying commitment to equality and ecology, with you know, active private markets and capitalists such as myself. I am a capitalist. I'm a green capitalist. That's kind of the framework. And yes, also well-being for good union jobs for workers. These things, you know, they seem outlandish now, but that's only because we've been living under neoliberalism for the last 40 years. And people, we've gotten to the point where we forget how extreme neoliberalism is. I was just teaching a class a few hours ago. We were going through data on the share of income in the United States that goes to the top 0.01%. In 1980, that share was 1% of total national income, and now it's 5% of national income. So in 40 years, the richest of the rich, from getting, you know, on average $7 million a year in income, they're now getting $33 million a year in income, and everyone else is getting less, of course. So, basically we're talking about reverting back to some more egalitarian form of a market economy. And where we go from there, let's see. But we have to solve the climate crisis within the framework of capitalism. Noam does not disagree with that at all.
Oh, I think.
No. Well, I was just doing an interview with him like 2 days ago, and he said exactly that.
Okay. I will take your word for it. When one reads the book, one does get classic Noam Chomsky. Let's put it that way. If you're looking for Noam Chomsky, here's Noam Chomsky.
Yeah.
And but the sections written by you and the sections written by him are separate and distinct. And you, someone looking for, and this is meant in the best way, Professor Poland, the wonkish parts written by you are what I was most interested in and found most interesting because I am trying to understand the economics of this. And
well, and so is Noam. That's why he wanted to do a book with me. I mean, Noam Chomsky is probably the most eminent public intellectual in the world and has been for decades, but he would never claim to be an expert on anything to do with the economics of climate change. So it's a mix.
It's a mix.
And yeah. Yeah.
That, and that's fine. The book is Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, The Political Economy of Saving the Planet by Noam Chomsky and Robert Poland. Professor Poland, thank you so much for being on the show and sharing your views. It is a important topic. It's an interesting topic. Your treatment, in particular, your treatment of it is, you know, part of that debate that we all need to be aware of as we, although most of us disagree about various elements of this, but of having to jointly face this issue and come up with a solution. So thank you for contributing to that part of the debate.
Well, thanks a lot. And it's been a great discussion. I appreciate you having me on.
My pleasure.